A Story of the Days to Come by H.G. Wells. 1. The Cure for Love. The excellent Mr. Morris was an Englishman, and he lived in the days of Queen Victoria the Good. He was a prosperous and very sensible man. He read the Times and went to church, and as he grew towards middle age, an expression of quiet, contented contempt for all who were not as himself settled on his face. He was one of those people who do everything that is right and proper and sensible with inevitable regularity. He always wore just the right and proper clothes, steering the narrow way between the smart and the shabby, always subscribed to the right charities, just the judicious compromise between ostentation and meanness, and never failed to have his hair cut to exactly the proper length. Everything that it was right and proper for a man in his position to possess, he possessed, and everything that it was not right and proper for a man in his position to possess, he did not possess. And among other right and proper possessions, this Mr. Morris had a wife and children. They were the right sort of wife, and the right sort and number of children, of course. Nothing imaginative or heighty-flighty about any of them. So far as Mr. Morris could see, they wore perfectly correct clothing, neither smart nor hygienic nor fatty in any way, but just sensible, and they lived in a nice sensible house in the later Victorian sham queen and style of architecture, with sham half-timbering of chocolate-painted plaster in the gables, Lincrusta Walton sham carved oak panels, a terrace of terracotta to imitate stone, and cathedral glass in the front door. His boys went to good solid schools, and were put to respectable professions. His girls, in spite of a fantastic protest or so, were all married to suitable, steady, oldish young men with good prospects. And when it was a fit and proper thing for him to do so, Mr. Morris died. His tomb was of marble, and without any art nonsense or laudatory inscription, quietly imposing, such being the fashion of his time. He underwent various changes according to the accepted custom in these cases, and long before this story begins his bones even had become dust, and were scattered to the four quarters of heaven. And his sons and his grandsons and his great-grandsons and his great-great-grandsons, they too were dust and ashes, and were scattered likewise. It was a thing he could not have imagined, that a day would come when even his great-great-grandsons would be scattered to the four winds of heaven. If anyone had suggested it to him, he would have resented it. He was one of those worthy people who take no interest in the future of mankind at all. He had grave doubts, indeed, if there was any future for mankind after he was dead. It seemed quite impossible and quite uninteresting to imagine anything happening after he was dead. Yet the thing was so, and when even his great-great-grandson was dead and decayed and forgotten, when the sham half-timbered house had gone the way of all shams, and the Times was extinct, and the silk had a ridiculous antiquity, and the modestly imposing stone that had been sacred to Mr. Morris had been burnt to make lime for mortar, and all that Mr. Morris had found real and important was sere and dead, the world was still going on, and people were still going about it, just as heedless and impatient of the future, or indeed of anything but their own selves and property, as Mr. Morris had been. And strange to tell, and much as Mr. Morris would have been angered if anyone had foreshadowed it to him, all over the world there were scattered a multitude of people, filled with the breath of life, in whose veins the blood of Mr. Morris flowed. Just as someday the life which is gathered now in the reader of this very story may also be scattered far and wide about this world, and mingled with a thousand alien strains, beyond all thought and tracing. And among the descendants of this Mr. Morris was one almost as sensible and clear-headed as his ancestor. He had just the same stout, short frame as that ancient man of the 19th century, from whom his name of Morris, he spelt it Muir's, came. He had the same half-contemptuous expression of face. He was a prosperous person, too, as times went, and he disliked the newfangled and bothers about the future and the lower classes, just as much as the ancestral Morris had done. He did not read the Times. Indeed, he did not know there ever had been a Times. That institution had foundered somewhere in the intervening gulf of years. But the phonograph machine, that talked to him as he made his toilet of a morning, might have been the voice of a reincarnated Blowitz when it dealt with the world's affairs. This phonographic machine was the size and shape of a Dutch clock, and down the front of it were electric barometric indicators, and an electric clock and calendar, and automatic engagement reminders, and where the clock would have been was the mouth of a trumpet. When it had news, the trumpet gobbled like a turkey, galloop, galloop, and then brayed out its message as, let us say, a trumpet might bray. It would tell Muir's in full, rich, throaty tones about the overnight accidents to the omnibus flying machines that plied around the world, the latest arrivals at the fashionable resorts in Tibet, and of all the great monopolist company meetings of the day before, while he was dressing. If Mears did not like hearing what it said, he had only to touch a stud, and it would choke a little and talk about something else. Of course, his toilet differed very much from that of his ancestor. It is doubtful which would have been the more shocked and pained to find himself in the clothing of the other. Mears would certainly have sooner gone forth to the world's start.